This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
Hi, I'm Steve Thiel, and that is Peter. So the willful breach doctrine in our paper is willfulness against expectation, a promisor-based defense, and our focus is on promisor willingness to have super compensatory remedies. The first line I'm somewhat embarrassed about, because until we realize we could hear, nobody finds willful breach doctrine embarrassing. But we were focused on this particular aspect of it, that in the bargain context, promisees expect expectation and pay for expectation and pay for the remedy. So a promisee who knows he's going to get expectation never wants super compensatory damages. Nonetheless, courts talk about willful breach and sound like, in fact, do award super compensatory damages for them, often cost performance measures, as in the cases we are going to talk about. So our thesis is that super compensatory remedies in cases of willful breach, defined later, can be justified as a tool to allow promisors to bind themselves to perform. In other words, while promisees do not prefer super compensatory remedies, promisors do. And that is what we are talking about. In this way, the idea that super compensatory damages for willful breach serve promisor and not promisee interests, I think we may be distinct from tort, where we don't think tortfeasors are interested in paying super compensatory damages as a general matter. Our premise, once again, is that awarded expectation is under-compensatory. Promisees don't recover uncertain damages, and that may include idiosyncratic damages in cases like PV House, we'll talk about before, where the value of improving the farm is very low, but the market value, but the value to the farmer is quite high. Don't receive consequential damages that they haven't disclosed. They may have reasons not to want to disclose them and won't be receiving those, and also have to bear the cost of litigation. So in a standard bargain contract, the promisee does not expect to be compensated even if he proves breach. In the face of that there's undercompensation, promisors are injured. Promisors who can credibly commit to perform, can credibly commit to give the promisee her expectation, will get more by making that kind of commitment. Now, how much of a commitment they make depends on how much it costs to make that commitment. Presumably, more of a commitment to perform if the cost of performance is low. We conclude, and I think we're right about this, that a promisor will always want to commit credibly, not to avoid a breach, not to breach, if he can avoid that breach at no cost. What that leads to is promisors prefer that promisees will receive super compensatory remedies for breaches that the promisor can avoid at no cost. We think that willful breach doctrine and discussion in the courts, the doctrine and dicta, screen for those breaches and particularly screen for breaches that produce no net benefit to the parties and can be avoided at no cost, or perhaps can be avoided at no net cost to the parties, in the sense that they can be avoided with efficient precautions. We think that's the best definition of what willful breach should be, and think, in fact, that is part of what courts are talking about when they talk about willful breaches. We think a particular advantage of what courts do in these willful breaches is the remedy they give. And the remedy they give typically, or in the case at least we talk about, is a remedy of cost of performance rather than punitive damages. Those damages are not punitive to the promisor. The promisor simply has to give back what he saved. It's a sort of promisor expectation measure. He disgorges his profits from the breach. In fact, it's not about compensating the promisee at all. We'd be happy to give these damages to somebody else. In fact, if this system works, we won't have these breaches. Although alternatively, there is a compensatory angle, and that is the promisor who gets cost completion, or it should be the promisee who gets cost completion, is able to get the value of performance if he has idiosyncratic values, simply by tearing out the pipes, for example. We illustrate that with two sets of cases, the middleman cases, which we wanted to call the middle person cases, but somebody else called the middleman cases, and the cost of correction cases that apparently everybody else thought we should talk about here. We're talking about PV House and Jacob and Young's. The middleman cases are infrequent, but in all the case books. You have a story of a producer who promises to sell a product to a middleman who's going to resell the product at a fixed markup to a downstream buyer. So a farmer promises to sell lettuce at a fixed price to a middleman. The middleman is going to sell that lettuce to a huge user, McDonald's, for a 1 cent a head markup. So the middleman is going to get a markup of 1 cent. That's what his expected profit is. Market price rises, seller doesn't deliver the lettuce, middleman sues and seeks contract price, market price under the UCC, but also under common law. He says, you agreed to sell it to me for 10 cents a head, it's now 15 cents a head, give me 5 cents a head. Seller responds, no.
Market price minus
cut. You got it back.
Associative principle, right? Market price against contract price, thank you. Seller then, his response is, no, the code indicates that we should give you only expectation. Your expectation was only the markup of 1 cent, so we want to limit you to 1 cent. Now, this case, we are going to say in some cases, is willful, though it occurred to me listening to Oren that this is never a willful breach case by them, because this breach is always going to be discovered. The middleman is going to know that there was no delivery here, and that's the only breach we're talking about here. All right, so what happens? Courts award in these cases, the courts split. When the seller breaches to sell his lettuce to somebody else at the enhanced risen market price, they will always give the middleman, they do always give the middleman the contract price, market price distinction, in my hypothetical 5 cents. But when the farmer's crop is destroyed, the other set of cases, then they only give the middleman his 1 cent. Now, what should we do in this case? We think that in all of these cases, contract market damages are appropriate. That if you think about the third party, that's not me. All right, if you think about the third party, buyer, McDonald's in that case, he's always, as we see it, is always going to agree with the middleman that they're going to hold out to get contract price market price. That there's some reason for this contract that we've inserted the middleman because the middleman has special skills. So we think that the parties would always agree to contract price market price. But the courts do split on that, as we say. And we think the distinction the courts draw reflects our theory of willful breach. Why? Because if the middleman only gets his 1 cent markup, he's not fully compensated for his expectation. He expected in this contract to get his 1 cent markup and to keep a happy third party. If he doesn't perform, but for some reason the third party can't or doesn't sue him, his business has still suffered some kind of damage to his goodwill. At the time of contracting, the farmer can make a promise not to sell the goods to somebody else if the price rises. That's a cost-free promise to him. He can simply say, even if the cost rises, I'm going to give it to you, and if it rises, you're still going to get contract price, market price. You're going to still get all the profits I make to somebody else. No cost to him to do that. Now, here's a place if you want to get angry. What do we mean by no cost to do that? First, I think there's no real cost here. This is just a transfer of wealth. There's an opportunity cost. And so maybe what we mean by no cost to the parties is no social cost. But our sense here is both that's the intuition of the courts, it's an intuition that we share. Also, the promisor seller has no particular incentive to want to hold out and say, if I sell to a third person, I get to keep the markup. Because there's never a credible commitment to that in these cases. The middleman can always force the promisor to disgorge the markup, the difference between contract price and market price, simply by covering. He goes out into the market and buys someplace else and delivers it to McDonald's. He's got cover, he's entitled to contract price, market price, and there's no argument that he's going to be limited to the markup. So we see this as a situation which promisor can promise in advance not to do this and not have to expend any remedies. Since he can, and that makes the promise more valuable to the promisee, the middleman who knows he's going to get performance and not going to lose this goodwill, in a situation in which the promisor, farmer, can make a promise that enhances the value of the promise to the middleman at no cost to the promisor, farmer, he is always going to do this. So this is a commitment that the promisor wants to make up front. Shift to the story of what does the farmer, is he willing to promise to give contract price, market price, if his crop is destroyed? To make that commitment, he has a substantial expense. He either has to somehow hedge the risk of his farm being destroyed, or he has to take additional precautions to make sure that his farm is not destroyed. So to make a promise to pay contract price, market price, if his farm is destroyed or his crop is destroyed, he has to incur expense. Now, perhaps the middleman will want to have him incur that expense. Perhaps he will not. But it's not transparent, or it's not always going to be the case that he is. So it is appropriate in this case that we can't be so confident that parties would agree in advance that the middleman is going to be entitled to contract price, market price, in the event of what I think other people have called inadvertent breach. And we think that is an intuition that students always seem to have, and it does match what the courts do. Next, the cost of correction cases that we've all been talking about. Cases in which promisors do less than they promise, but they claim that perfect performance would not justify the cost. This is the PV House case, and it's also Jacob and Young's. Is that a willful breach by us? Groves, the other PD House case, this is a case where somebody is supposed to regrade. The court said it was a willful breach, by which I think they meant that they did it on purpose. PD House, where the majority says nothing about it being a willful breach, where the dissent says it is a willful breach. In Groves, cost of performance is given. In PD House, diminution in value is given. By us, both of these cases are wrong. PD House should have been given cost performance because that was what was really bargained for, perhaps idiosyncratic value in farmers. Groves is wrong because this was industrial. Cost of completion was really, or value of completion was all that the promisee wanted. But whether they're right or wrong, they're not willful breaches by us because performance or avoiding breach is very expensive. You have to restore the farm, you have to restore the lot. So these aren't ours. Willful breach cases are Jacob and Young's and their variants. First one, accidental breach. That's the one reading of the Jacob and Young's case. The plaintiff receives only diminishing value for breach that is expensive to correct. How could the builder have prevented the breach by checking his pipe every day, somehow expending money? Does the promisee, the owner, want to pay for that excess precaution? Or pay for super compensatory damages? No, not if he's not harmed. If we accept that he is not harmed, the damages are fully compensable there, he won't always want to do so. Shift the case in Jacob and Young, in which the owner breaches and uses co-hose pipe instead of Redding pipe. The pipe is functionally identical, but the substitute co-hose pipe is cheaper. Now that's not the story there. What should we do in that case? That case might be efficient. We expended fewer resources to get the pipe, and the pipe is just as good. So we're not sure that this also satisfies our vision of a willful breach in the sense that avoiding this breach has some kind of cost. Still think that the owner ought to be entitled to cost of completion. That will force the builder to announce that he's going to be using this alternative pipe. We may worry, and I think here we probably are agreeing with Orrin and Omri, that the use of substitute pipe, we shouldn't be so confident that he's using substitute and identical pipe. So in this case, I think we would want disgorgement remedy, either the cost of completion, the $60,000 to tear it out, or at least the money saved, the $1,000. Last is our last version, which we call Jacob and Juvenile, a deliberate breach that is costless to prevent. So here we would have somebody who breaches by mistake. Now, if you read the paper, you know we said that doesn't actually happen, but it turns out that the case that is the most important case in next year's contracts book is exactly a deliberate breach that could have been avoided at no cost, and that is this one. And in this situation, a contractor in New York City, a subcontractor, put a Red Sox jersey into the Yankee Stadium. Now, the cement is just as good with the jersey in there. It was just a joke. Turner, the contractor, says leave it in there. Yankee Stadium says don't leave it in there. And in fact, pay people to come in on Saturday and spend an enormous amount of money to take the cement out and to take this out. Yankee Stadium actually paid for all of that. Turner says we're not liable. Yankee Stadium agreed. Yankee Stadium paid a tremendous amount of money to have this torn out and replaced, and is now going against the subcontractor and the individual. But our sense in this case is it's a perfect case for cost completion, that they ought to be, Yankee Stadium ought to be entitled to all of this money. The breach could have been avoided at absolutely no cost. Just don't do it. You know when you're doing something juvenile. And while there is no harm to the promisee, or there's harm to the promisee, how much has Yankee Stadium been harmed, or the Yankee organization been harmed? Tough to know. But certainly, Turner and its subcontractors would have promised in advance not to do this, and says you can really be mean to us if we are. Now, a couple of other things about this, and I think I missed a slide. One is the damage idea here. And as we said before, we think our damage idea here, that an advantage of the damages of the cost of performance that are being awarded in these, or the contract price, market price, is simply to deprive the promisor, the breaching promisor, of his profits from breach. It's not to punish him. He's in a position he would have been in had he simply performed. Now, Judge Posner, in his paper for this program, suggests, I think, that if we're concerned that compensatory damages, or the damages are not fully compensatory, fix that problem, raise compensatory damages. We're not sure we always want to, and I think particularly in the Hadley against Baxendale case. Suppose in Jacobs and Young's against Kent, the owner is related to Redding Pipe, and he wants to use Redding Pipe because this has family value to him. That has, and in fact, he'll tear down the whole house. We don't want to hold the contractor, the builder, responsible for that unless he's been informed in advance. It's sort of a consequential damage rule. Now, our system doesn't undermine the owner's incentive to disclose that he has this special value here, because he's only going to get cost of completion or supercompensatory damages if there's a willful breach on the part of the promisor, and he can't control that or predict that. So this system allows us to keep the advantages of subcompensatory contract remedies, particularly mitigation or the Hadley against Baxendale rule, but also allow for more credible commitments than we think people want. And that takes me to the end.
Question?
Back to the distinction that you make between a willful breach and the, you know, saying that that the seller breaches no self-proof.
Third party.
The middleman has no way.
Yes.
And then you say that there is reputational losses, and that would be a reason to reward the damages, even though the middleman, excluding the reputation, suffered no losses, right?
Correct.
Now, and you distinguish it from the case of the destruction of property.
Right.
And this is something which is puzzling for me. Well, first of all, I'm not sure that the reputational losses should necessarily be different between a case in which the middleman cannot provide the property because it was destroyed, or because it was not delivered by...
And I agree. I agree that in both cases, ordinary damages are going to be subcompensatory.
Okay, so the point is that even if the middleman, excluding reputation, right, if the middleman suffered no losses, right, I mean, because he, right, I mean, he has an exemption vis-a-vis the...
Right.
The buyer.
Ultimate purchaser.
Right. So still, he would have a good reason to provide incentives, ex ante incentives, to the seller to take some precautionary measures that the property would not be destroyed.
Yes.
So therefore, there should be damages.
Yes, I agree. I agree that, in fact, in both cases, contract price, market price is the appropriate remedy. I think it's the appropriate remedy because the buyer, the middleman, may want to encourage incentives,
right.
But those incentives are going to be costly. They may not want them as much.
Yeah.
But most of all, I think that the third-party buyer, is the buyer and the middleman and the ultimate buyer are never going to want to allow the seller to get out of it.
Okay, I see that. Okay, that's one point. So I thought that it's kind of a normative argument that you make. Maybe it's more about distinction between cases.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Now, but one more thing that I really wasn't sure that I understood is the following, right? I mean, if I'm the middleman and I enter into a contract with the buyer, I get some benefit if I can say to the buyer, you know, with my contract with the seller is a contract in which the seller has efficient incentives,
right?
And that would be a good reason for me to insist of having to receive damages, even if I suffer no harm, because again, if I can reveal it to the buyer, I would get a better price.
Yeah, I agree, and I would, and that's why I think that the remedy ought always be contract price, market price. But I wouldn't say it's always the case. I have no problem with the middleman saying to the seller, if you breach selling to the higher market, you only got to give me a cent. You can keep all of that. And the consequence is that then the seller will sell to the middleman at less than the existing market price. So this is a default rule that can be varied. Now, I note that's never the case. The cases are always contracts at market price.
I hear Judge.
I see, Judge. Thank you.
Oh, I have two questions about your paper. So the first, these middleman damages, I think middleman damages are fine. But I don't think your argument that the reason for giving this apparent windfall is that, you know, he's lost a good relationship, he's angered people who the middleman and so on. I think the problem, I think if you buy at a fixed price and you have a contract to sell at a fixed price, you're engaged in a kind of speculation. You downside and upside. And I think this kind of this damages rule is just to make sure you get the upside. If you're lucky, you get to keep that profit. So that's the second point has to do with Jacobs and Young. I think Warren made the same point. It's not all clear to me. This also relates to your comment about willful breach damages. I'm not clear that's a willful breach. There are two theories about this. The specifications of the brand in a building contract. One is, which is implicitly yours and Warren's, is that it's to make sure that the builder doesn't, you know, substitute an inferior brand, but it would be difficult to prove. The other theory, this is Todd Rakoff's theory, so I think he has some experience in business, is that these specs, these very detailed specifications of building kinds, are really designed for the guidance of the architect rather than to protect the buyer. And if the architect is content with that substitution, fine. And of course, that also means that the price of the building is going to be lower if the builder has more flexibility. So I worry about your, you know, rather casually classifying a set of breaches as willful and then, you know, using that determination to throw the book at the defendant and then, of course, increasing the risk.
Let me taking separately the first one, the middleman case. I agree with you that the remedy always ought to be contract price, market price. But we're left with the fact that that isn't the remedy. The courts do limit contract price, market price to the markup in the case when the crop is destroyed and give contract price, market price only when the crop is sold to somebody
else. When you say destroyed, do you mean force majeure destroyed or?
It's not an excuse. There,
it's not, okay, what is not an excuse? Crops destroyed, not individual action.
Raisins were not available because of storms. Lettuce was not available because of storms. There was not an excuse. It was not enough.
Force majeure, isn't it? A storm.
It was not enough to be an excuse for the farmer.
Okay.
It is. No, yeah.
Okay. Just
but the farmer was not excused. And so the cases draw a distinction. In the architect case, I've heard a couple of explanations, and I think they all go close to the point that there was simply no breach here. that in fact redding pipe just meant ductile iron pipe and co-hose was okay, or if it was that it was just designed, that so long as the architect was satisfied, everything is okay, and if in fact the architect was satisfied, I'm fine with that if you say there's no breach in these cases. But if there is a breach, if there isn't some explanation that co-hosed or redding pipe in the contract in the writing meant something close to that or something the architect says it is, once we find that it is a breach, then I find it to be a, then my argument is that it's a breach can be avoided at no cost, the parties would agree that you can get money by agreeing not to breach your contract at no cost, and so you would agree to do so.
Yeah, I want to go back to the sort of the middleman case, which I think is very nice, and ask the following question. Do we want to think of this as a two-party transaction or a three-party transaction? Well, because what happens is when you sell out and the middleman has to buy from somebody else at a higher price, what's the guy who's being hurt is essentially the ultimate purchaser who now has to pay the differential. So suppose, in effect, what we said is we're not going to use middleman contracts because of the low damages. I think what you would start to see is that people then start going to agency-type contracts in which you're buying for this other character, and since at that point the principal would be the first guy who'd get the full level. Well, suppose we now think that there's actually an efficiency in having middleman contracts as opposed to agency-man contracts. Giving the higher damages is, in effect, the way to preserve all the relationships up and down the line by protecting the third party, who now gets it, by definition, at the lower price. So isn't that really what the explanation is as to how these cases work? I think it's consistent with what you said, but I think it's also that you want to be much more explicit about the tripartite nature of the
relationship. I do, and I hope we are in the paper, and that's why we think it always ought to be the case. But doesn't your argument indicate that you ought to get contract price, market price, even when the crop is destroyed?
Well, actually, you know, that's the interesting question about it, because in some of those cases, you might want to say that the willful breach and the excused breach do make a difference, and with respect to the willful breach, where the ability to train to transform positions is sufficiently great, you want to put very heavy stuff on. But it's much, you don't want to worry about incentivizing guys in the force majeure case. And so at that point, what you have, and this was an argument that, you know, the Posner-Rosenfield 1977 article, which I thought was wrong on some of the particulars, but the intuition that some cases is, well, I have to take a team shot. I mean, but
I thought it was great.
But the basic intuition, forget about whether the particular case is sorted out one way, is that you always have the incentive function against the insurance function when you're evaluating those contracts. And this is a case in which, when there's force majeure, it's a kind of a marker which says that the incentive function really isn't important. And at that point, the ability of a larger guy, McDonald's, to absorb the fluctuations would suggest that, in a strange sense, it's actually a kind of an efficient solution in the strong sense of that term.
And I think the problem I have is that I don't think these middleman cases are right. I wouldn't follow this distinction. But the problem is the contract prices that the middleman made with the third party were the same. They were market-based prices. They were market prices, which meant that so long as the middleman covered it, he was entitled to contract price, market price. Mm-hmm. So I think that, as a matter of fact, he was buying insurance, and he could have gotten the insurance simply by covering. But except for that, I've got no problem.
Okay. I mean, of course, the cover issue is force majeure, maybe much more difficult because if one guy gets knocked down, you'd be like...
And that is that one of the cases there was nothing else available, and that's why I didn't buy. I don't think that's the case always.
And that's why
I didn't follow.
Because, diversification, when you think of this thing as a web of potential to grow as middlemen and so forth, you do get geographical
And I think we do say that the insurance thing is also being functioned. We can well imagine that the buyer is the best person to do it. Yes, sir.
Let me go back for a second to the architect. So if you treat it as a breach, I mean, suppose that it's a breach because it was written into the contract and was primarily intended to the architect. If you treat it as a breach, you're going to give the owner, you're going to give him restitution. I mean, you treat it as a willful breach, you're going to give him restitution. In other words, you're going to give him the cost saving of the bill.
Okay. I have not been calling that. I call that disgorgement, not restitution. But yeah, that's what I'm going to give him.
Okay. That's, of course, that's not a standard kind. That's not the standard remedy. Standard remedy would be the loss of value.
Yes, sir.
To the owner. I would be much more comfortable treating it as, you know, ordinary breach, where, yes, if there's a value diminution for the owner, he gets that. But I don't think you, if the builder can break the contract by substituting some brand, which is Justice Flip, he saves money. Then I think it's, if you want to call it a breach, it should be a breach with zero damages, because that's the optimal solution. The costs of builders will be lower, and the purchasers won't be harmed.
Except that the owner knows that he may be subject to breaches that won't be discovered. That this pipe might not actually, that they use Coho's pipe, and they use a more poorer quality pipe, but he never learns about it.
Well, that's serious.
Pardon me?
It's possible. Is that the kind of problem?
That's not this case.
You know,
well, it's a concept that justifies supercompensatory remedies.
Because you have to worry about problems of proof.
Steve, do you say Jacob and Young's was a willful breach?
No, our story on Jacob and Young's is not a willful breach.
Or better, a willful breach is justified by the fungibility.
Our version of willful breach is breach that can be avoided at no cost. And that breach couldn't be avoided at no cost. That may be part of what you're saying, because you'd have to be more careful about it. And why be more careful? We still think it's a good, you can make the argument that you ought to have supercompensatory breach. That is not, in fact, our willful breach.
Well, why do you say avoided at no cost? Why not avoid a level of precaution?
Reasonable
cost.
We would. No cost is easy for us, and I think and how far do we push this? We push it as far as you just said.
Okay.
I had that written down to say.
I'm a little confused about what you just said about no cost and the Jersey case, because in the Jersey case, you said that's a no cost case, but the employer actually has to supervise a lot to make sure there are no residents.
Well, it's kind of an interesting thing.
In the set of workers.
Fair.
So why is that no cost, but not the case with the pipes?
You've got me there, though interestingly, Turner doesn't face, nobody's claiming they have this obligation. Now, the sub does have to supervise, and there is some cost to that. And so you're right, it's not a costless. The rest of the facts is the guy who does it is a day laborer at the sub who's never been in the business and got in there, so it would have been a very, very low cost. But you've got me, there is some cost there.
I mean, generally, like your account of what no cost is, as well, I can see that I can either do it or not. But as long as you have multiple actors and the possibility of inadvertence.
Whenever you have agency, you have some cost?
Agency, you have a cost in order to try to make yourself.
Okay, let me shift the case there that the head of Turner Construction threw the sweatshirt in. Then it's a no cost. But I don't claim to have many cases, but when I have a no cost, and in fact that's what he said, there were none of these joke cases. Then I thought, great, we got a joke case, and it turns out it was a much funnier joke funny on me than I thought. But so we're not thinking that that's what's really going on. And so what we're really pressing to is cost justified.
I'm sorry.
I just thought other people didn't call on you first.
No,
I don't
realize that. Don't go away. The point that I'm saying.
Richard, I think you quoted
me. Oh, really?
No, yeah, you're out.
All right, so I didn't remember it. What happened? The problem is he's been. One of the difficulties that we have in this case, where willfulness really does seem to matter, nobody's talked about it, and it's an extension of where this case breaks off, is all of these, basically the substantial performance with a minor gap, and the question is whether or not you give, when there's a slight change in the quality of the product, you give the rejection of the goods on the one hand, or the allowance of the goods with a monetary damage situation. Now, that's a long line of cases. And if you go back, the dominant solution in that case is clearly turns on willfulness in the naive sense. If you substituted that thing in an inferior fashion or a conscious point, even if there is a perfect differential, generally speaking, they allow you to throw it back. Whereas if it's an inadvertent one, you use the cash only if the party's on the same indifference curve after they pay. But that is clearly a case in which willfulness is used in its naive sense, and it is not used in the way in which all you economists are using it. You other economists are using it.
I've got an economist. I'm a lawyer.
Okay, I know that. But I do think that you really, if you want to put this theory together, it would be very useful to look at the rejection case.
Okay, and we will do that. That wasn't a question. So.
Well,
I'll have to read them
later.
I
want to
go back and take another crack at the middleman cases. If the parties, the middleman and the seller were to get together and say, what happens if the price goes up from 200 to 500? The seller would say, let me off the hook. I'll give you a big discount now. And you say, there is an offsetting cost because now the middleman says, wait, but I have a problem with my own buyer. But that's not a symmetric problem. First of all, at most it is this kind of vague thing that you call the goodwill. In light of the fact that it's not much of goodwill because with the client, the middleman had a different arrangement. An arrangement in which the middleman can just cancel delivery. It wasn't such a firm delivery contract like the middleman negotiated with his own seller, and if he found a buyer who's willing to let him off the hook, so that buyer doesn't care as much about delivery, the downstream buyer, at most will inflict upon the middleman a small cost, so on the one hand you have a big saving for the seller, on the other hand you have a small cost on the,
that's
surely the parties would not have agreed to contract market differential.
Yes, they would have, and I have no problem if they want to come up with something else. And this is a rule they could vary that way. They did not give a discount to the market price, and a middleman's whole business depends on keeping his other people happy. So my take is yes, almost certainly the middleman, it had even the middleman and the seller talked, they would have agreed that there was going to be contract price, market price. I think that's a fairly easy case because the middleman is going to have some incentive to recognize the interest of the ultimate buyer. But then I also say it didn't happen in this case because there was no discount in the market price. But if they do agree to it, that's fine. So I got a default rule, maybe I'll be the other way around, but that's not particularly, I'm not going to go over time to talk about that.
Okay, so it seems like a good place to stop.
Thank you.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.